This evening, I want to speak on something that God has been speaking to me about over the last little while. It's something he's been taking me on a journey with, actually for a few years now. And it's something that always confused me and puzzled me when I was growing up. So we get taught, as we grow up, a whole load of stuff. So we get taught about music, we get taught about science, we get taught about whatever you're into, sport, you get trained in that and stuff. And yet, probably the thing that shapes us more than anything else in our lives are relationships. So those are the things that form who we are. Those are the places that we find peace and we find security, or those are things that can destroy us sometimes. And one of the things that has always confused me, or at least that no one ever really taught me how to have, is friendship. And so I want to speak tonight about friendship and about what the Bible has to say, because my experience has been whenever I'm confused about something, if I come to this book, God has loads of wisdom on it, and he has loads of guidance, and it's incredibly practical. And there's a few occasions where I've really felt my confusion about friendship quite keenly. So one of those was when I started off at university. And I remember the first day I arrived at university, Mike actually dropped me off. And I remember I had just a whole load of boxes of stuff. And so I took these boxes up to my room. I don't know if you've ever started a new school, you know, when everyone else seems to know each other. But you feel a little bit vulnerable. And I remember just walking into this college where I was going to be studying for the next few years and just feeling like overwhelmed and just feeling scared. And I don't like admitting this to you, but it's true. I remember going out to my room and putting my boxes down and just sitting on the bed and crying. And just being like, oh, is anyone gonna like me here? How am I gonna fit in? And then I made some great friends at university, but there was more than one occasion where I remember there was this bar in the college where I lived. And every time I walked past this bar, it sounded like everybody in there was having a great time. So I would sometimes go in and other times I wouldn't. But there was loads of times where I would want to go in because it sounded like it was all happening in there and there was this great party going on. But I just would be too scared. I'd be nervous. I'd be worried. What if I go in there? There's no one who can speak to me. No one will include me. So I'll just look like this lemon sort of standing there. I'll have to buy a drink, drink it quickly and then leave. And I also remember with the dinner hall, getting my tray, getting some food, putting it on the tray, and then being really, again, nervous about, is there anyone going to be in the hall who knows me? Is there anyone I can go and sit with? And sometimes there would be, and they say, oh, Andy, come and join us. And other times it would be, no, I just literally have to sit there by myself and eat as quickly as I could and then get up and leave and hope no one noticed. But it confused me also because it seemed to me that loads of other people seemed to have loads of great friendships. And I was puzzled by that. And loneliness, it's been said, is the great poverty of our part of the world. The great poverty of the Western world is the poverty of loneliness. And I think I'm probably not the only one that's had moments and times when I felt lonely. And the thing about loneliness is I used to think, oh, if you're surrounded by people, then you're not going to be lonely. But that's not what loneliness is. What loneliness is it's like a lack of connectedness to people. It's that feeling that no one really knows who I am and no one really cares about me. If I weren't here, I wouldn't be missed. No one would know me. That's loneliness. And so you can feel that in the middle of this room. You can be sitting here in the middle of the room and surrounded by people and feel like no one knows you. You can be lonely in a family. You can be lonely in a youth group. You can be lonely in a church. You can be lonely in a classroom. And so loneliness is that lack of connectedness. And so a little while ago, I began to look at what the Bible says about friendship. And I want to teach a little bit about it, just a few things just to get us started, just rapid. If you go through the Bible, there's all sorts of things you pick up. The first thing that I picked up when I was looking at this is that, number one, we're made for friendship. That's how we've been designed. So in the Garden of Eden, when God makes the human race, we were just singing about it, where he breathed us into life, there's this verse that comes in Genesis chapter 2, verse 18. And up until that point, God's been looking at everything and saying, this is good. He makes the light, it's good. He makes everything, it's good. And this is the first not good that comes in the whole Bible. So Genesis 2, verse 18, it says, the Lord God said, it is not good for man to be alone. It's not good for us to be alone. And by that, what it means is more than just Adam needs Eve. What it means is human beings, we're made to connect with each other. We need relationship. The thing that's crazy about that is that happens before sin comes into the world. So before what we call the fall happens and the world becomes broken and imperfect, in paradise, in Eden, God looks at that and says, this is not good. Because even if you live in paradise, but you live there alone and you're not connected, then there's something instinctively in us as human beings that knows that that's not quite right. And we all know, you know, imagine you won the lottery, £100 million or something like that, and you bought a giant house and you could afford like a private jet and you just had everything you wanted. We would all know instinctively if we had all of that and we lived without really being connected to another human being, there would be something that was missing. And so what that says to all of us is, oh, that explains why I work the way I do. That explains why there's something in me that wants to connect, whether it's online or it's in person. I'm longing for connection. That's the first thing I've picked up as I looked at it. The second thing that I noticed as I was skimming through the Bible is that good friendships are rare. So there's actually not loads of them. There's some we can look at, and I want to look at one particularly, but there's not loads and loads of great friendships in the Bible. So there's a proverb that I love, and it says, Proverbs chapter 18, verse 24, a man of many companions comes to ruin, but there is a friend who sticks closer than a brother. And what's that? What that is getting at is that actually really good friendships, you can have loads of companions, as it were, loads of acquaintances, maybe loads of friends on Facebook and loads of followers on Instagram. But real friendships, close friendships, and that's what I'm talking about this evening. I'm not talking about just people that you know and you kind of know them a bit and you hang out every now and then. I'm talking about real close friendships. They're rare. So you've got maybe like Moses and Joshua, Ruth and Naomi, you've got Paul and Timothy, and you've got even Jesus, the Son of God himself, had the 12 disciples. And then within the 12, he had three people it looks like he was really close with, James and John and Peter. And then of those three, people say maybe John's his best friend, maybe Peter's his best friend. But even Jesus only had a few. And one of the myths that we buy into, this is what I've bought into anyways, if you're popular, you won't be lonely. So if loads of people like you, and if you get loads of followers on social media or whatever, you're not going to be lonely. The higher the number, the lower your loneliness level. But it doesn't work like that. Because the thing that combats loneliness is not quantity of friends, it's quality. It's not the number of relationships that you have, it's the depth of relationships. So they're rare. And the third thing that I picked up is that good friendships, great friendships, the way it works is they're other-centered. So they're focusing on other people. Because the way I used to think it worked is, if I want to get loads of great friends, I have just got to make myself awesome. So I've got to just look so good. Basically, like I've got to cover myself in honey, and then the bees will come swarming, and they'll want to hang out with me, and that's how it's going to work. And actually, what the Bible teaches about that is almost the opposite. It's like that you want to get great friends. The solution it gives us is be a great friend. So it says, Jesus says this in John chapter 15, starting verse 12. He says, my command is this, love one another as I have loved you. Greater love has no one than this, to lay down one's life for one's friends. So we're made for friendship. Good friendships are rare. You're not going to have many, only a few sometimes in a lifetime. And friendship's about focusing on others. So this talk is not about how to get great friends. It's how to be one to someone else. And I want to look as an example for us, so two of my favorite people in the Bible, my favorite friendships that you can find in the Bible, and it's found in the book of Ruth. So if you have a Bible, you might want to open with me to the book of Ruth. You'll find it right towards the start. It's after another book called Judges. The words are going to come up on the screen. But basically, the story of Ruth starts with a lady called Naomi. And her and her husband live in Israel, but there's a famine in Israel. So they decide they're going to make a new life for themselves. And they move away to a foreign land called Moab with their two sons. When they're living in Moab, both their boys end up getting married to these two Moabite women, one called Orpah and the other one's called Ruth. And then as time goes by, Naomi's husband dies. And then both her sons die. It's a very tragic story. So both her sons then die. So then Naomi is left in this foreign land, Moab, with her two daughters-in-law, Ruth and Orpah. And she decides one day, I've just had enough of this. I'm going to pack this in. I'm going to go back to Israel and try again and try and make a new life for myself back in Israel. So she gets up to leave. And the bit I want to read from is when she's on the road with her two daughters-in-law, and she's basically saying to them, don't come with me. You guys, there's nothing for you back in Israel. You need to stay here. And this little story from 3,000 years ago, it's incredible how it speaks to us today. So I just want to read a little bit to you. So that's the scene. They're on the road. And then it says in verse 8, then Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, go back, each of you, to your mother's home. May the Lord show you kindness as you have shown kindness to your dead husbands and to me. May the Lord grant that each of you will find rest in the home of another husband. Then she kissed them goodbye and they wept aloud. And they said to her, we will go back with you to your people. But Naomi said, return home, my daughters. Why would you come with me? Am I going to have any more sons who could become your husbands? Return home, my daughters. I am too old to have another husband. Even if I thought there was still hope for me, even if I had a husband tonight and then I gave birth to sons, would you wait until they grew up? Would you remain unmarried for them? No, my daughters. It is more bitter for me than for you because the Lord's hand has turned against me. At this, they wept aloud. Then Orpah kissed her mother-in-law goodbye, but Ruth clung to her. And as far as I can tell, that's the only record in history of anyone clinging to their mother-in-law. But it's in the Bible, so it's true. Right? And then it says, and then Naomi says, verse 15, look, said Naomi, your sister-in-law is going back to her people and her gods. Go back with her. So Orpah's gone. Orpah's like, all right then, if you insist, I will head back to my own people and my own gods. And then Naomi says to Ruth, look, the other one's gone. You're off the hook. No pressure. You can go too. And then Ruth says these words to Naomi. And if we get what she's saying in these words, then we understand the secret of what it is to be a phenomenal friend to another person. So Ruth says this to her mother-in-law. But Ruth replied, don't urge me to leave you or to turn back from you. Where you go, I will go. And where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if even death separates you and me. When Naomi realized that Ruth was determined to go with her, she stopped urging her. So there's three things I want to pick up from that. The first thing that Ruth says to Naomi, the first thing for us to be thinking about when it's like, how can I be a Ruth to somebody else? How can I be a friend to somebody else? Is I will go with you. Now, I'm going to ask, if you're here with your boyfriend or girlfriend, okay, they're in this room with you, would you just stand where you are? We just want to have a look at you. So wherever you are, just stand. There's no need to applaud them. All right? So first of all, okay, the first thing to do here is, guys, just look around at everybody who's not standing, okay? These are the people that are available to you. Find someone you like the look of. All right. Secondly, look at these people, okay? Because what I'd suggest to you is you probably want to try not hanging around with them when it's just them and you, when there's three of you. Because we've probably all had an experience. Let's say that you guys need to stay standing. Let's say you kind of, after this finishes, you're going to stay in here and you're going to watch a film. Now, let's say it's the three of you. You're sitting there watching the film. They're sitting next to you watching the film. You look at the film because that's what you do when you watch a film. And then after a little bit, there's a funny bit or whatever, and you want to turn to your friends here and you see, what's that funny? And then you look at them and what you see is they're there gazing into each other's eyes and they're watching the film in the reflection of each other's eyes. Okay, let's say that you're having dinner, okay, and it's the three of you and someone's made spaghetti or something like that, spaghetti bolognese. You're sitting there and you're just having a nice time. You reach for the garlic bread. By the time you've turned around, the two of them are there gazing into each other's eyes, joined by a piece of spaghetti. That's the common kind of thread. And you think, oh my word, this is disgusting. Let's say that you are hanging around at your campsite. You know, you've got a little campfire going on there. It's just the three of you sitting around the campfire. You're looking up at the stars thinking, what a beautiful night. And then you look back down and they're not even there. And they've disappeared. So you follow them into the tent that they've gone into. And what you see in the tent is they're sitting an appropriate distance apart from each other, gazing into each other's eyes, doing nothing else. We're watching you. You can sit down. All right? That's how it works with couples, yeah? The way it works with couples is they spend all this time looking at one another and just being like, oh my word, I adore you. I love you. This is amazing. The way it works with friends is different. Because what friends do is rather than standing opposite each other, gazing at each other, what they kind of do is they stand shoulder to shoulder, side by side, and they're gazing at something that they're looking at something they have in common. So the point is, it's like they're it's not about just each other necessarily. It's about doing something together. So you see what Ruth is saying to Naomi is, hey, well, she's not saying, let's just sit on this road together and just hang around on the road. She's saying, okay, let's go somewhere. You want to go somewhere? I'm going to go too. You want to have an adventure? I'm going to come with you. The way that C.S. Lewis puts it is he says this. He says, people who simply want friends can never make any. Friendships must be about something. Even if it were only an enthusiasm for dominoes and white mice. He's talking at a time when white mice were the equivalent of like a PS4. Even if it were only an enthusiasm for white mice. Then he says, those who have nothing can share nothing. Those who are going nowhere can have no fellow travelers. So it's not so much that we make friends, although that does happen. But it's kind of a bit like you discover a friend. You know, when you meet somebody and you're like, oh my word, you love that too. It's kind of like we're looking at this thing that we have in common. You love that too? I thought I was the only person that loved that, but you're into it as well? So Mike and I, you obviously have noticed that we are friends, but there's a slight edge, a slight competition that goes on between us. And when we're back in Watford, we try and go to the gym together, and we try and compete at the gym. And I remember... We compete, right? So we compete on all sorts. We compete on the bench press. And it is impressive. I remember he travels around the world. So we're always in touch whenever he's away. And I got this text from him a little while ago. It says this. Did you get to the gym this morning? I went twice yesterday. Going again this morning. Need to make sure I don't lose muscle. Can you see how I am preparing for you? It is no longer about staying alive and being healthy. It is about beating you. And so there's this thing, like you have something in common. You bond over something together. That's how friendships begin. That's how they start. You discover that someone else has a passion. And there's a way in which not only can that be a natural thing, like you both love the same kind of music or you're both into watching films or whatever it might be. It's not just a natural thing, but often the best friendships, not always, but often the best friendships grow. And there's also that supernatural connection as well, where you love God at the same time. So I don't know if you've ever found yourself sitting on a bus or next to a train. And you're sitting there with another Christian, but you don't know. You know, they're just a stranger. And then one of you blows your cover. So they start listening to a Hillsong album or whatever. Or they get their Bible out. And you realize at that point, oh my word, this person's a Christian as well. And then you've got that situation. Do I let them know that I'm a Christian? Yeah, how do I know? I love that song too. And then it's like code for we get each other, yeah? And I found I can talk to people I've just met who are followers of Jesus. And within a few minutes, you get each other because you get Jesus and you've got Jesus in common. So what friendships are is they grow around something that you hold in common. Obviously, Jesus is the ultimate, but to share ambition with somebody else, to share goals together. So one of the things Mike and I love to do, obviously, is compete. We also love watching The West Wing together. We've watched it millions of times and we quote it to each other. But also what we want is we want to go on an adventure. You know, we're both we want to serve Jesus together. And that's an adventure that we're having. And for as long as it's the right thing, we'll do it with Soul Survivor. If it ever becomes not the right thing, the Lord will take us on another adventure, but we're going somewhere together. So one question to be asking is who am I, not just what am I meant to do with my life, but who am I meant to do it with? Who are those people? And there'll only ever be a handful where it's like this, but where it's like, who are those people that I'm called to go somewhere with? I will go with you. The second thing she says to Naomi, she says, I will stay with you. And this is a tough one. This is about commitment. That's one word for it. And it's been said that the way that we work in our world, the way that we think about friendships, the way that we think about relationships has become kind of the way that we think about shopping. So the way that we do shopping is we're looking for a bargain, aren't we? So we go out there and basically we want to get something that kind of where the benefits for us outweigh the costs to us. So you kind of do that with a phone contract. If it gets to the point where your phone contract is like the cost to you is greater than the benefit, then you just look for an upgrade. You look for something else. And that's sometimes the way that we can treat relationships, where it's like, I'll be friends with you so long as the benefits outweigh the costs. The moment it becomes difficult for me, the moment that like you're taking more from me than I'm, you know, than I'm getting back in return, then I'm afraid I'm gonna have to look for an upgrade. And that's not how real friendship works. That's not how biblical friendship works. Friends, it's been said, are the people that stay when everyone else is walking away. They're the ones that are walking in when everyone else is leaving. And for Ruth, in this moment, saying that statement, I'm going to stay with you, that was a tough thing for her to say for loads of reasons, all right? Reason number one, Naomi is a bitter old woman. Her life has not gone well. And actually, when she goes back, it says later in the story, when they get back to Israel, everyone's like, oh, Naomi, it's so good to see you, right? What Naomi means is pleasant. That's what her name meant. Oh, pleasant. It's so nice to have you back. Welcome back. And do you know what she says? She says, don't call me Naomi anymore. Call me Mara. Mara means bitter. So she's like, I don't want you to call me pleasant anymore. I want you to call me bitter. Have you ever met an old lady whose nickname is bitter? Like, you know, like, oh, bitter. Great. Let's hang out. Come round. This is going to be fun. So she's bitter. Another reason why for Ruth it would have been an easy thing to walk away is that Ruth is a Moabite. And that means she's a foreigner in Israel. So she's got no prospects. If she goes back with Naomi to Israel, she's going to be alienated. According to the law, they weren't really meant to marry people that weren't Jewish. So she's basically kissing goodbye any prospects, any good chances she's got of finding another husband. Another reason why it would have been hard for her to have stayed with Naomi is Naomi is saying, go away. You know, she says it pretty strongly. Leave me alone. Don't come back with me. I don't want you to come back with me. And that's hard to stay with somebody that's telling you they want you to go, isn't it? It's hard to stay with someone who's telling you they want you to leave. And what happens, my experience has been anyway, one of the things that sometimes happens in relationships is that people are pretty guarded. And when things get tough, that's when all the walls go up. So I remember there was a time when I was at university with this, and I was actually sitting in the bar with this guy that I knew, and he was a little bit drunk, but he was, he'd just been dumped by his girlfriend. And I remember him having this conversation with me, and he was saying, although he was a bit drunk, he was really serious. And he said, do you know what, Andy, I've just been dumped, but I'm going to be all right. And he said, you see, the way that I understand my life is I'm a bit like a castle. So I have like this outer wall, and then I have this inner wall, and then I have this keep right in the middle. And he said, sometimes what I do is I let people behind the outer wall, and sometimes I let people behind the inner wall, but nobody ever gets into the keep. Nobody ever gets in to really see what's going on in me. And I totally got what he was saying, because that's how I've lived a lot of my life as well. But as I reflected on that afterwards, I thought, gosh, that must be such a lonely way to live. You let people in behind some of your barriers, and sometimes one or two people get behind some of your other barriers, but no one ever really sees you. No one ever really knows you. You've got stuff that you've never said to anyone. And we do it because we want to protect ourselves. But what it means is that so often, without realizing it, we're living in a quiet loneliness. And what happens is, for the people that we're friends to, when life becomes hard, what loads of them do is they push us away because they don't want us to see their shame. And I do the same in return. We don't want people to see us when we're at our worst because we feel vulnerable, we feel horrible. And what's going on with Naomi here is she's doing just that. Leave me. Just leave me. My life's gone horribly, horribly wrong. You guys just don't come with me. I need to deal with this. I need to go off by myself. I need to put all my walls up. I need to put all my armor on. I'll sort life out for myself. And one question to ask is, how do we respond to that when our friends are going through that sort of stuff? I remember I worked for a few weeks in a hospital as like a chaplain. So my job was to just go around and talk to people. And in one day, I had three conversations with these elderly people, and in three separate conversations, and all of them told me they wanted to die. I remember saying to them, why are you saying that? Well, you know, what are you saying that for? Why do you want to die? And they just said to me, all three of them separately, I don't want to be a burden on anyone. I don't want to be a burden. I get it. But the way that God set this whole thing up is that I am made to be a burden to you. And you are made to be a burden to me. And we're meant to carry one another's burdens. So think about it like this, all right? How do we respond when someone's pushing us away? One of the best examples I've ever come across of friendship is in The Lord of the Rings. Now, I don't know how many of you have seen the films. They're quite old now. But if you haven't seen them or if you haven't read the books, The Lord of the Rings, basically in a nutshell, what it is it's about this little hobbit called Frodo who has to chuck a ring in a volcano. It just takes him 9.5 hours to find the volcano. Or 3 long books. So that's it, what it is. And this ring represents this really evil, horrible burden, okay? And there's this one particular moment in one of the films. If you haven't seen it, I will act it for you now, right? There's this one moment in the film where Frodo realizes what a terrible burden he's got and how he's going to have to go to Mordor, which is this horrible, nasty place. He doesn't want to put his friends in danger. He doesn't want to be a burden to his friends. So he decides, much like Naomi does, I'm going to do this by myself. I'm going to go off alone. And so there's this battle that takes place. And when the battle when there's all these orcs attacking them, Frodo realizes this is his moment. So he runs off to the river and he gets in this boat and he starts rowing away. Meanwhile, his best friend, Sam, realizes that Frodo is doing a runner. He figures out what Frodo is up to. So he runs down to the river as well. And then this is what happens, right? Sam calls out to Frodo when Frodo's in the boat and he goes, "Mr. Frodo! Mr. Frodo, come back," right? And then Frodo goes, "No, Sam, no, go back, go back." And then Sam goes, "Come back, Mr. Frodo." And then Frodo goes, "No, I need to do this by myself." And then Sam wades into the water, right? And he starts swimming towards Frodo. And then Frodo stands up in the boat and goes, "Go back, Sam, go back. You can't swim." And then Sam goes, because by that point, he's under the water. And then you have this moment where Sam is like, he's got all his pack on, and you see him going under the water, and it goes into slow motion. So you sort of see Sam's hand reaching up towards the surface of the water, and you think, "Oh my word, what's going to happen? It looks like nothing's going to happen." And then suddenly Frodo's hand plunges into the water, and you see Frodo pulling Sam up onto the boat, and Sam kind of gets up coughing and spluttering. And then he says, when he's recovered after a minute, he says, "Where were you going, Frodo? Where were you going without your Sam?" And when some of our friends, right, when they go through anxiety, depression, when their parents get divorced, when they fail their exams, what they want to do is push us away. And our job is not to solve their problems. Don't take that on yourself, because we can't do that. But what our job is to do is to say, "No, I'm staying. I'm not walking away from you. Here I am. And I'm not going anywhere." That's what Ruth does for Naomi. And then the third thing, she's obviously been to drama school because she's building this momentum. And you can feel that, she says. So she says, "I'm going to go with you. I'm going to stay with you." And then she says, "And I'm going to die with you." She says, "Even death won't separate us. My corpse and your corpse are going to be holding hands in the grave." You can't say that to many people, but maybe a few. Maybe there's a couple. And that's the way that we're called to do friendship is so often it's not how I've done it. All right? So the way that I've done love is on a good day, the way that I love people is how they love me. So I'll generally love you how you love me. So if you do the washing up, I will probably try and say something nice back to you at some stage. If you buy me a birthday present, I will probably buy you a birthday present of a similar monetary value. We love people in the way that they love us, but that's actually not the standard that Jesus sets. So remember that verse I read at the start in John 15? He says, "Love one another as I have loved you." So my job is not to love you how you love me. It's to love you how Jesus loves me. And the way that he loves is sacrificially. So what the world tells us is the main way you express love is sex. The Bible thinks sex is great, but what it says is the main way you express love is sacrifice. You sacrifice for another person. You prefer them. And so that thing of, "I'm going to die for you," well, that's Ruth saying, "Look, I'm going to prefer you. I'm going to put you first in this relationship." If you both do in that, if that's a mutual thing, then this wonderful friendship develops. And One of the mistakes that we can make, right, is we think we've got two choices. Live for yourself and be happy, or live for somebody else and be miserable. And what Jesus says is, no, 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 the way to finding your life is to lose it. And so through sacrificing for another, you find tremendous joy and you find tremendous fulfillment. And there's a cost to any great friendship. There's always a cost to it. So one of the costs is you have to forgive the person that you're friends with sometimes. Because friendships are not when one perfect person becomes friends with another perfect person, you have a perfect friendship. That's not how it works. What is one broken person is friends with another broken person, and you get on each other's nerves sometimes. So there'll always be, you know, if there aren't times when you have to forgive the other person, probably deep friendships are never going to grow. And there's always a cost to forgiveness. Another thing that sometimes a cost to us when we're friends with another person is that sometimes we have to speak the truth to them. And we have to say, actually, you know, I'm not sure about that. And we do that because we love them, not because we want to correct them, but because it's like, man, I love you so much. I don't want to see you doing that or making that mistake. So I'm going to tell you the truth when it would be easier to keep my mouth shut. And one of the things that I love about my friendship with Mike is that he will tell me the truth. He'll say things to me that I don't want to hear, and it's probably easier for him not to say, but he'll say it. So I remember there was this time, not long after I graduated, where we were driving along in a car, and I said something. I can't for the life of me remember what it was now, but I remember saying it and thinking after I said it, gosh, that was an incredibly arrogant thing to say. And so after a minute, I turned to Mike, and I just said to him, hey, mate, I'm just wondering, I think I'm getting quite up myself. And do you know what he said to me? He looked at me, and he was being deadly serious, and he said, yes, I've been meaning to talk to you about that. The git. And that hurt, right? And then he told me a few things that he said, just watch this and just be careful about that. And it would have been so easy for him not to have said that. He did it because he loved me. There was a time when I was speaking, I went to speak at this university, and I gave this talk, and Mike came along to support me, and then after the talk, there was a Q&A, and I asked Mike for some feedback afterwards. I said, tell me honestly, what did you think, where could I improve? And he said, well, listen, I think you did all right in the talk, but in the Q&A, and this is a direct quote from Mike, senior pastor of Soul Survivor Watford, he said, in the Q&A, you came across like a bit of a knob. And then, right? And then he did an impression of me, okay? So then it was like, and then you said, blah, 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 and he did proper impressions. I was just dying as he told me. But what it is the wounds from a friend, again, it's a proverb, are to be trusted. You want to have people who love you enough to tell you the truth. And we want to be, and the reason you know that you're doing it because you love them is because you don't want to do it, but you're willing to anyway. There's always a cost to friendship. And what it is we want to get to a place where there's a few people in our lives where when they succeed, when they fly, we celebrate. And it's like their victories are our victories. And when they lose at something, when something goes wrong in their life, we weep with them too. Who are those people that could be? You could be that to someone else. It has to be a mutual thing, but who can you be a Ruth to? Who can you say to, I'm going to go with you, I'm going to stay with you, and I'm going to die with you? And the final thing I finish with is that this begins with our close friends, but it will have a much, much bigger impact. Think of it like a stone. If I picked a stone up, threw it into a pond, that stone would land and then it would ripple out. And friendships like that and relationships like that, that's what happens. Jesus says, by this shall all people know that you are my disciples, that you love one another. And this world that we're living in is dying in loneliness. The thing that I think will speak to it more than almost anything else are churches full of relationships like that. When they come in, they think, gosh, that's an incredible friendship you've got there. That sounds a lot like what I've just heard the Gospels about. And then they hear the Gospel and they think, flip, that's a lot like that friendship that I see in those two people over there. And they begin to realize that they're called and they're invited into something so much bigger.